All right, everyone, welcome back. Ready for another deep dive? We're tackling some serious ground today. Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. We're talking foundational stuff here.
Yeah, these books are really key to understanding so much about, well, faith, history, even culture today.
It's like trying to understand a building without knowing anything about the foundation.
Exactly. And our listener wants to get to the core of these books, the big picture stuff.
Right, not just skimming the surface, but really grappling with the themes, the connections, the tough questions.
Like, what's going on with those census numbers and numbers? Millions of Israelites wandering the desert. How does that even work?
In Leviticus, I'll admit it's the one I struggle with the most. All those laws, the sacrifices, it can feel pretty dense.
It can. But we'll unpack that. Leviticus is actually super important for understanding references to rituals and sacrifices throughout the rest of the Bible. It's all connected.
Okay, well, I'm ready to dive in. So, Exodus. Most people know the basic story, escape from Egypt, right?
Yeah, the plagues, the parting of the Red Sea, it's pretty epic.
But I have a feeling there's a lot more to it than just the escape itself.
Definitely. You've got liberation, the giving of the law at Mount Sinai, and then the creation of the
The
tabernacle.
tabernacle, that's what always fascinates me.
Yeah, it's a pivotal moment. This visual representation of God choosing to dwell among his
It's
people.
not just like, hey, let's set up a tent and hang out.
Right. Think about the description in Exodus 40, when the cloud, representing God's presence, descends and fills the tabernacle. It's this incredible moment of God is here with us.
It's such a powerful image, but what does it actually mean? God dwelling among his people. It feels hugey.
It's about intimacy, presence, relationship. This God who created the universe chooses to come down and live among his people. It's like he's saying, I'm not distant, I'm not unapproachable, I want to be with you.
Wow, yeah, that reframes it completely. It's a blueprint for how God wants to relate to humanity even today.
Exactly.
Okay, so we have this dramatic climax in Exodus, God dwelling among his people. Then we move to Leviticus, which, I'll be honest, has kind of a reputation, right?
Yeah, it's often seen as the rule book of the Bible. A bit dry, maybe even a bit scary.
All about what you can and can't do.
The name itself, Leviticus, comes from the focus on the Levites, the priestly tribe. But if we get stuck on just the rules, we miss the heart of it.
Which is.
Leviticus is all about how a holy God can dwell with a people who, well, aren't always so holy.
Okay, yeah, that's the big question, isn't it? We're messy humans, and God is. Well, God, by God, how do you bridge that gap?
And Leviticus explores that tension. It's not random rules. It's a guide to understanding how to approach God, how to live in right relationship with him.
It's like a relationship manual.
In a way, yeah. A lot of it focuses on the sacrificial system. It's this core idea of atonement. You can't just ignore sin, pretend it doesn't exist. It needs to be dealt with.
So the sacrifices were a way of acknowledging that gap, that separation caused by sin.
Exactly. A tangible way for the Israelites to experience forgiveness and restoration.
Okay, but I'm still stuck on the tangible part. It's hard to wrap my head around animal sacrifices. It feels, well, ancient.
It is. But it's key to remember that those sacrifices were pointing forward to something greater, more permanent. They were foreshadowing Jesus.
Ah, okay, now we're getting into typology territory.
Right. We'll unpack that more as we go.
Awesome. I'm definitely intrigued. Okay, so we've got Exodus, Leviticus, and then Numbers.
Another one that can be a bit intimidating.
Yeah, the name itself doesn't exactly scream excitement. Numbers, like what? Are we going to be doing math problems?
It gets its name from the two censuses taken at the beginning and in the middle of the book.
Ah, okay, so that's where the numbers come in, but
In
it's
a
not
tangent.
just about numbers, right?
The Hebrew title, Bemidbar, actually means in the wilderness.
In the wilderness. Now that sets a totally different mood, much more evocative. So what's happening in Numbers?
It chronicles the Israelites' journey from Mount Sinai to the edge of the Promised Land. Think of it as a travelogue, but with divine intervention.
Sounds like a wild ride. We're talking about a massive group of people wandering the desert for. How long was it again?
40 years. And it wasn't just about physical movement. It was a time of testing, refining, wrestling with their relationship with God.
Wow, 40 years. Lots of time for doubt, rebellion, and probably a lot of manna.
Definitely. But seriously, those 40 years represent a crucial stage in their development as a nation, learning, growing, coming to grips with what it meant to be God's chosen people.
So it wasn't just about reaching the destination, but about the journey itself, what they learned along the way.
You got it. And there's a powerful parallel there for our own spiritual journeys, right?
Yeah, totally. Our own times of wandering, uncertainty, wrestling with faith. Okay, but before we get too introspective,
we got to talk about those census numbers.
Right. We're talking over 600,000 fighting men, which means millions of Israelites in the desert. It just seems a lot.
Yeah, it's definitely a head scratcher. And it's caused a lot of debate among scholars. Some take the numbers literally as historically accurate.
But that's where we run into problems, right? Trying to reconcile those numbers with other biblical accounts, archaeological findings.
Exactly. So we've got some unpacking to do. It does seem like a bit of a logistical nightmare, right?
Millions of people wandering in the desert for 40 years. How do you even begin to provide food and water for that many?
And shelter. And keep everyone moving in the right direction.
And then there's the issue of, well, wouldn't that have left some pretty significant archaeological evidence?
Right, you'd think so. But the evidence just doesn't seem to support those kind of population numbers in the region at that time.
So what are we to make of these census figures?
Well, like we were saying, there are a few different schools of thought. You have those who hold to a literal interpretation, accepting the numbers at face value.
But then how do we reconcile that with those other challenges we just mentioned? The logistics, the archaeology, even the descriptions in Deuteronomy.
Exactly. So that's where other interpretations come in. Some scholars suggest that the numbers are intentionally exaggerated.
Intentionally? Like, why would they do that?
Well, maybe for literary or theological emphasis. It's not about a precise head count, but more about conveying a sense of scale. You know, yeah. The vastness of the Exodus, the sheer number of people who were chosen by God.
So it's more about the grand sweep of the narrative than a literal accounting of every single person.
Right. But then there's a third group of scholars who propose something even more interesting. They suggest that maybe we're misunderstanding the Hebrew text itself.
Misunderstanding? What do you mean?
Well, they argue that our modern understanding of how ancient cultures use numbers might be off. Maybe the word eleph, often translated as thousand, didn't always refer to a specific quantity.
Hmm. Okay, that's intriguing. So what else could it have meant?
Well, some scholars point to examples in other biblical texts where eleph seems to refer to something more like a clan, a family group, or maybe even a military unit.
Like in Judges 6.15, where Gideon talks about his eleph being the weakest in Manasseh. Doesn't sound like he's talking about a literal thousand men in that context.
Exactly. And it's not just a random theory. There are linguistic and historical precedents for this kind of flexible use of numbers in ancient cultures.
So it's like, maybe we're getting tripped up by trying to apply our modern, very quantitative mindset to an ancient text that used numbers differently.
That's a great point. Maybe they were more concerned with conveying symbolic meaning or broader concepts than providing a precise headcount.
So those census numbers, even if they don't represent literal millions, still communicate something powerful about the scope of the Exodus and the magnitude of God's involvement.
Exactly. And I think this whole discussion highlights something really important about approaching ancient texts. We need to be careful about imposing our own modern assumptions onto them.
Yeah, like trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. It just doesn't work.
Right. We need to be open to the possibility that their way of thinking, their use of language, their understanding of the world might have been different from ours.
It's a humbling reminder that we don't have all the answers, and there's always more to learn and discover.
Definitely. And I think that's part of what makes studying these ancient texts so exciting. They challenge us to step outside our own limited perspectives and to grapple with big questions that have resonated throughout history.
Speaking of big questions, I'm really curious to hear more about this concept of typology. We touched on it earlier, but I think it deserves a deeper dive.
Absolutely. And it ties in perfectly with what we've been discussing about the Old Testament foreshadowing the New Testament. So why don't we pick up there next time?
Sounds good. It's like we've been trying to decode a secret message using the wrong cipher.
I love that.
Ah.
And once you find the right key, the whole message opens up in a new way.
Exactly. So maybe those census figures are less about giving us a precise headcount and more about conveying something about the scope of the Exodus, the vastness of Israel's journey, the magnitude of God's provision.
It's about painting a picture, creating a sense of awe and wonder. And I think that's something we often miss when we get too caught up in the literal details.
We lose sight of the forest for the trees, right?
Exactly. We need to step back and see the bigger picture, the grand narrative that's unfolding across these books. And that's where typology comes in.
Okay, yes. Let's dive into that. I'm ready to unpack this whole idea of the Old Testament foreshadowing the New Testament.
Great. It's like these stories, these rituals, these laws, they're not just isolated events or ancient practices. They're pointing forward to something greater, something more permanent.
They're like shadows cast by a future reality.
That's a beautiful way to put it. And that future reality is, of course, Jesus Christ.
Okay, so can we get specific here? Can you give me a concrete example of how this works?
Sure. Let's take the Day of Atonement described in Leviticus 16. Once a year, the high priest would enter the Holy of Holies, the most sacred space in the tabernacle, to offer a sacrifice for the sins of the people.
Right, I remember reading about that. They would sprinkle the blood of a bull and a goat on the mercy seat, right?
Exactly. It was a powerful symbol of cleansing and forgiveness. Hmm. But it was also a foreshadowing of what Jesus would ultimately accomplish.
Okay, I'm starting to see the connection. Jesus as the ultimate high priest, offering the ultimate sacrifice.
You got it. Think about Hebrews 9.1 of the 12. It says, "But when Christ came as high priest of the good things that are now already here, he went through the greater and more perfect tabernacle that is not made with human hands, that is to say, is not a part of this creation. He did not enter by means of the blood of goats and calves, but he entered the most holy place once for all by his own blood, thus obtaining eternal redemption."
Wow, those verses are amazing. It's like the author of Hebrews is taking this Old Testament ritual and showing us how it points directly to Jesus.
Right. The Day of Atonement becomes a lens through which we can understand the greater reality of what Jesus accomplished on the cross. And this is just one example. The book of Hebrews is full of these connections.
It's like these ancient practices weren't just random traditions. They were part of God's grand plan, his narrative of redemption, culminating in Jesus Christ.
Exactly. And that changes everything about how we read and understand the Old Testament, doesn't it?
It definitely does. It's not just about memorizing facts or following rules. It's about recognizing how everything points to Jesus and the ultimate story of redemption.
It's about seeing the Bible as a unified story, with Jesus as the central figure. And that's what makes studying these texts so rewarding. It's not just about acquiring knowledge. It's about encountering the living God who reveals himself through his word.
It's like we've been given this incredible treasure map, and we're finally starting to understand where it's leading us.
And the journey is just as important as the destination.
Well, I know I've learned a ton today. We've covered so much ground, from the Exodus from Egypt to the intricate laws of Leviticus to that epic journey through the wilderness.
And along the way, we've encountered themes of liberation, covenant, holiness, sacrifice, and ultimately redemption.
It's been a wild ride. But a good one.
It has. And, you know, what's really exciting is that these texts are still speaking to us today. They still have the power to challenge us, to encourage us, to transform us.
They're not just ancient history. They're living words.
Exactly. So keep exploring, keep digging deeper, and keep the conversation going.
That's great advice. Thank you so much for joining us on this incredible deep dive into Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. It's been a privilege to learn alongside you.
It's been my pleasure.